Chapter 25. The 3rd of December was Vic's birthday. Vic hadn't thought of his birthday until November 29th, when he was calculating the day an order of sepia inks should arrive. And then he put his birthday out of his mind again, because he had heard no mention of it around the house. Two or three birthdays of his, in the past few years, had gone unnoticed except by Stephen and Carlyle, who always remembered and gave him a present, either singly or together. On December 3rd, Stephen gave him a large and costly book of 18th-century English engravings, and Carlyle a bottle of brandy, which Vic opened at once and sampled with him. Then, when Vic walked from the garage into the living room that evening, Melinda and Trixie and the Mellers greeted him with a roaring, "Happy birthday!" The table was aglow with candles, and there was a big pink-and-white cake on it with little pink candles to the number, Vic supposed, of 37. He pocketed the sleeping snail that he had just found on the garage door jamb as he came in. There was a heap of presents at one end of the sofa. "My goodness," Vic said. "How'd you people get here, fly?"
"I picked them up so you wouldn't see the car when you came in," Melinda told him. She was wearing a very feminine and fetching black dress with black lace at the shoulders.
"And you'll have to deliver us," Horace said. "That means I can drink all I want to tonight. We've already started, I'm afraid, but we'll brim the glasses again and drink your health."
They all sang a chorus of "Happy Birthday, Dear Vic" to him with lifted glasses, and Roger barked all through it. Even Roger was sporting a red ribbon tied to the back of his collar. Then came the presents. Melinda handed him three tied-together boxes from Brooks Brothers, each of which contained a sweater, one a mustard-colored coat sweater, one blue and red, which was an Italian import, and the third a white tennis sweater with a red stripe. Vic adored good sweaters. He was touched to the point of feeling a lump in his throat that Melinda had given him three. Horace gave him an electric razor with the remark that he had been trying to convert him for years from his straight-edged razor, and that he thought the only way was to put an electric razor in his hands. Then from Trixie, an ebony brush and a comb, and from Roger, a woolen tie. Mary gave him a latest edition of a carpenter and woodworker's manual, a book Vic was never without, though he hadn't bought this edition.
"I wonder if I should give him his other present now, or after dinner?"
Melinda asked the Mellers anxiously. The Mellers said to give it to him now, and Melinda went to her room and came back with a large box wrapped in gold paper. She set it down on the floor.
"I wasn't sure how it works, so I had it at the back of my closet in the dark," she said.
Horace laughed. He and Mary obviously knew what it was and watched him expectantly as he unwrapped it and opened the corrugated box inside. It was a Geiger counter, complete with headphone, probe, and shoulder strap. There were even ore samples. Vic was speechless, delighted. He went to Melinda and put his arm around her. "Melinda, thanks," he said, and pressed his lips against her cheek. When he glanced at the Mellers, they were regarding him and Melinda with satisfied smiles, and Vic felt at once self-conscious and a little silly. Out of character. Perhaps that was it. Because Melinda was out of character. She was acting just as he had used to act, deliberately displaying an emotion or an attitude that was unlike the emotion or attitude he felt within himself. He and Melinda had essentially exchanged attitudes, Vic felt, since now he believed that his behavior was truer to what he really felt than he had allowed it to be in years, and that Melinda was pretending her goodwill. During the dinner, squabs,
mashed potatoes, braised endives, and watercress salad. He tried to relax and really not to think, because he was groping in his mind for clues, for leads, as a man in a dark room that he has not been in before might grope for a light pull, knowing the light pull exists, yet having no idea where. He was hoping that the aimless play of his brain might brush against the reason for Melinda's goodness. After Delisle's death, her decorum had been for the public, but this was for him. She was thoughtful and polite to him when there was nobody around to see her. But, of course, the public reaction to the second murder, it startled him a little that he called it murder in his thoughts now, had been different, too. There had been a great deal more suspicion of him in regard to Delisle than to Cameron. He had had it lucky that Havermal had been such an unpopular fellow. Havermal's story of the romance and intended elopement of Melinda and Cameron, therefore, had been considered highly suspect, or greatly exaggerated by the majority of people who had heard it. Vic had been impressed by the fact that Trixie had not come home with a single canard against him. The only thing she had brought home to tell him was that one of her classmates had said that her parents had said that people liked to pick on people who were different from other people. Trixie had not really grasped what she was saying, and Vic had had to think to make sense of her words himself, but it seemed to be the old story of the conforming majority against the non-conformer. In this case, his non-conformance being his income, he supposed, his non-profitable publishing business, his tolerance of his wife's affairs, his television-less household, and perhaps even his superannuated car. Vic had given Trixie a talk then on persecuted minorities and individuals with examples from history. Trixie was going to be a conformist par excellence after her childhood, Vic was sure. But he liked to think that he might have opened a small door in her mind about nonconformers. He had made the story of Galileo as interesting as he could. When the time came to drive the Mellors home, Melinda wanted to go, too. That had not happened in years. No one could have said the evening was not a success. The closest to it, Vic thought, had been the first birthday Melinda had celebrated in Little Wesley about 9 years ago, when they had also invited the Mellors. But as he started out of the door into the garage with his sweaters and his Geiger counter, he was struck by the contrast of his isolation now with his closeness to Melinda then. And he stopped, turned around, and went back into the living room. Melinda was in her bedroom, starting to remove her dress. "I wasn't sure I thanked you enough," Vic said. "It's the nicest birthday I can remember."
"I think you thanked me," she said, smiling. "Do you mind unfastening this? I can't reach the middle part."
He put everything down on her bed and unhooked the rest of the hooks and eyes that went down the middle of her back.
"Who hooked you up?"
"Trixie. She's asleep now. Would you like a nightcap?"
A faint chill went up his spine.
"No, thanks. I thought I'd go over and try my counter on that crazy conglomerate rock in my room."
"What rock?"
"I guess you haven't seen it. It's been there for months, though, in the corner by the filing cabinet."
She looked as if she were about to say, "I want to go with you and look at it, too." And he hoped she wouldn't. She didn't. She looked from him down to the floor, then turned and began to pull her dress over her head. "So I'll say good night," Vic said, walking to the door.
"Good night, Vic. And happy birthday."
He tried the counter, following the directions in the instruction book. After a moment, he heard a click, then another, then a longer pause, and three more. The rocks in the conglomeration were of varying ages, of course.
He put the set away, feeling tired and a little troubled. As soon as he lay down in bed, he thought of the way Melinda had asked him if he wanted a nightcap. Tentatively, as if she didn't know him. Or was that it? He felt an echo of the same unpleasant chill. It was fear. And why did he have it? Just what had he to be afraid of if he had had a nightcap with her in her room, sat on her bed, perhaps even slept in her bed? His mind shied away from further imaginings and returned to the fear he had felt. He didn't know why Melinda was being so friendly. That was part of it. He supposed it was the main part. He decided to proceed with even more caution. Not be cold or unreceptive, just proceed with caution. Too often he had swallowed her bait and found himself wriggling on a hook. All he wanted was peace in the household, he reminded himself. Once there was real peace, a peace that could be trusted. Well, he could go on from there when he came to that. The following evening, with really no forethought about it, Vic had a nightcap with Melinda in her room. She had not asked him into her room. He had simply brought her highball into her and sat down on a chair. But once there, he was uncomfortable and began talking to her about getting some new curtains for her room. "Oh, I don't care," Melinda said. "Curtains are awfully expensive. And after all, who sees them?"
"That's right, who sees them?"
"Well, you."
"I never look at them." She was sitting in front of her dressing table, brushing her hair. "You know, Vic, I'm glad I didn't go away with Tony. I like you better," she said matter-of-factly. "You don't mind, do you?"
"No."
"Well, do you?" She smiled at him. He found her self-consciousness fascinating. "No. I'm glad you behaved the way you did. About Charlie, too."
"What do you mean, behaved?"
"Oh, you never really lost control. And yet they both knew you didn't like them and wished they'd disappear. Maybe Tony did just disappear. Go to another town, I mean."
She waited. "Well, I'm glad you realize that," he said gently after a moment. "You may hear from him someday, a note of apology. He's got a conscience."
"A conscience? Do you think so?"
"More than Delisle had, anyway."
"We'll never hear from him, will we?"
"Not bloody likely, poor guy."
"They're both poor guys. Compared to you." She was standing by her night table lamp now, working at one nail with an emery board.
"What makes you suddenly think that?"
"You think so, don't you?"
"Yes. But you've never thought so, even when we were first married."
"Oh, Vic, that's not true."
"I can remember, right after we were married, you were happy, and yet you weren't. You couldn't make up your mind if you'd made a mistake or if you couldn't do any better. So your eye started roving, long before you did."
"I just stare at people," she said, with a shy smile.
He smiled in return.
"Aren't I staring at you lately?"
"Yes."
"Why?" "I have my reasons."
"I'll bet you have." He laughed. She went wide-eyed, off balance.
"Don't kid me, Vic."
"Did Trixie tell you the joke she heard today? Two turtles were walking..."
"And don't change the subject, for Christ's sake, I'm trying to be nice!"
she yelled. He smiled appreciatively. She sounded like herself again.
"I just meant..."
I was trying to tell you that I admire you and that I like you. I like everything you do, even your keeping snails, and I'm sorry for the way I've acted in the past.
That speech sounds as difficult as a grade school valediction.
Well, it isn't difficult. I made it because I think I have quite a lot to make up for.
Melinda, what are you up to?
She came toward him. Can't we try again, Vic?
Of course, he said, smiling. I've been trying all along.
I know.
She touched his hair. He barely kept from flinching. He stared at the edge of the rug on the other side of the room. He loathed her touch. It was insulting, he felt, simply insulting, considering all that had happened. He was glad when she took her hand away.
Tomorrow's Saturday, she said. Shall we make a picnic lunch and go out somewhere with Trixie?
I'd like to, but I promised Horace to go to Wesley with him to pick out some building materials. He's building a shed. Isn't it getting a little cold for picnics?
I don't think so.
What's the matter with Sunday?
I think Trixie's doing something Sunday.
Oh. Well, maybe you and I can go on a picnic Sunday, he said pleasantly. Good night, Melinda. Sleep well.
He went out. Chapter 26. Trixie was doing something on Sunday. A little boy named Georgie Tripp was having a party, and Trixie was invited and wanted to go. Vic had to drive her there at 1 p.m. Trixie had thought she knew how to get to where the Tripps lived. It was out of town on a country road, and she had been there before. But she got lost, and Vic had to go back to the house for the directions that Mrs. Tripp had given to Melinda by telephone that morning. When Vic got back to the house, he found Melinda on the telephone talking to Don Wilson. Her back was to him as she stood at the telephone in her room, and for some reason, perhaps because he hadn't closed the car door, she hadn't heard him come back. He knew that from her intense voice as she said, "I don't know, Don. I can't tell you anything." "No." And then Vic's steps made a sound on the hall floor. He was not trying to walk quietly, was simply approaching slowly, though he was wearing his rubber-soled sports shoes. And Melinda turned and looked startled. Then she smiled into the telephone and said, "Well, that's all for now. Gotta go. Goodbye."
"I think I'd better take that paper with the directions after all," Vic said. "Trixie got lost."
Melinda picked up the paper from her night table and handed it to him. The frightened surprise was still on her face, and it reminded Vic a little of her expression when he fed her scrambled eggs late at night, except that now she was not drunk.
"How's Don?" Vic asked, already turning to go out of the house.
"Oh, all right, I suppose."
"Well, see you in about half an hour," Vic said, smiling. "Maybe a little more."
Vic was back from the Trips in 35 minutes, and they started off almost at once.
"Do you mind if we go to the quarry?" Melinda asked.
"Why not, since we haven't got Trixie?"
"That's right. Why not?"
he said agreeably. He spent the next few seconds reviewing the tones of her voice, trying to decide if she suspected anything about the quarry or not. Got tired of it, and tired of the piddling mentality, his own, after all, that had prompted him to wonder if she suspected anything. What if she did? It wasn't going to ruffle him. He could see himself and Melinda in a few minutes, huddled by a wind-blown fire, chewing chicken bones. Cavemen without a roof. He chuckled.
"What's the matter?" she asked.
"Oh, nothing. I'm just happy, I guess."
"Sometimes I think you're losing your mind. Did you ever think that?"
"I probably lost it years ago. Nothing to worry about."
As he approached the overgrown lane that went off the dirt road to the quarry, he asked, "Is this about the place?"
"Don't you know?
We haven't been here in so long."
No reaction.
The twigs, harsh and more leafless now, scratched at the sides of his car as it lumbered through the lane. Then they came out on the familiar flat in front of the excavation and stopped. Vic remarked that it was a fine, clear day, and Melinda murmured some reply. She looked as if she were pondering a tack again. But it wouldn't be a tack about the quarry, Vic thought. He began to whistle as he gathered kindling for a fire. He let his search for kindling take him to the edge of the quarry, within 6 feet of the spot where Cameron had gone over. The little inlet where Cameron had sunk was half in shadow, but nothing seemed to be floating there. Any stains, of course, would probably be invisible from this height, but he squatted on his heels, rested his chin on his thumb, and peered for them anyway. Nothing that he could see. When he stood up, turning at the same time, Melinda was not 5 feet away. She was approaching him with a solemn, set expression, and instinctively, he braced his feet and smiled.
"Well, I've got this much,"
he said, holding up some wood he had gathered.
"Shall we try it?"
He walked toward the rock they had selected as a shelter for the fire, but Melinda did not follow him. Vic looked back when he got to the rock and saw her staring down at the quarry. He wondered if she was going to propose a walk down the path to the bottom, and he decided that under no circumstances would he go down. Not that the place made him uneasy, he thought, but that there might be bloodstains, and she might notice them. They might not look like rust stains, but at this moment she had no plans. He could tell that from her relaxed, purposeless stance at the rim of the quarry. After a moment, she came back toward him and proposed having a drink. They poured 2 glasses of iced scotch and water from the thermos and ate a deviled egg as a canapé. The fire was doing nicely after a stubborn start. It was certainly not warm, but Melinda stoically took off her polo coat, spread it to lie on, and stretched out on the rock facing the fire. She was wearing her old buff-colored corduroy slacks and her old brown sweater that had holes at the elbows. They had forgotten to bring the lap rug, Vic realized. Vic sat down rather uncomfortably on the rock to one side of Melinda.
"What did Tony really say to you that day he took a ride with you?"
Melinda asked suddenly.
"I told you what he said."
"I don't believe it."
"Why not?"
She was still staring into the fire. "Didn't you take him for a little ride and just dump him somewhere? Dead?"
"Dead? How?"
"Maybe strangled,"
she said with surprising calm.
"Didn't you dump him somewhere in the woods?"
Vic gave a short laugh. "Good Lord, Melinda!" He was waiting for the quarry, perhaps, to cross her mind. She might have been going over, now, all the places in the woods where he might have dropped a body. Melinda knew these roads so well. Hadn't she thought of the quarry? Or would she think that he couldn't possibly have caught a big fellow like Cameron enough off his guard to have pushed him over? That was Vic's only explanation of her not thinking of the quarry.
"Aren't you getting hungry?" Vic asked. "I'm ready for a piece of chicken."
Melinda dragged herself up to help Vic unload the picnic basket. Roger was very interested in the chicken, but he was not allowed to have any. Vic sent him off chasing a stick. Then he and Melinda, just as he had foreseen, huddled near the fire and chewed their chicken. But Vic wondered if even in primitive times a man and a woman whose relationship was more or less marital had ever known such mistrust of each other. The conversation of a few minutes before had not dulled Melinda's appetite for lunch. Vic smiled, watching her concentration on a chicken breast. They talked of buying Trixie a bicycle for Christmas. It was Vic's idea. Then Melinda said,
"You know, Vic, I think you killed Charlie and Tony, too. So why not admit it to me? I can take it."
Vic smiled a little, his suspicions confirmed. The purpose of her sweetness and light lately had been to make him believe she was on his side.
"And then have you go to the police and tell them I've made a confession?"
"A wife can't testify against her husband, I've heard."
"I've heard that she doesn't have to."
"She can."
"But I just meant, as long as I know it,
is this all you and Wilson can dream up between you?" he asked. "It isn't good enough."
"You admit it, then?"
She looked at him, her eyes full of triumph.
"No, I do not,"
he said quietly, though he felt angry. Or perhaps it was only embarrassment that he felt for her. He remembered her embarrassing pretense of affection for him the night he had sat in her room. His anger drove him up. He wandered to the edge of the quarry again and looked down. And there, now, in the twinkling water, he saw it. It was next to the step where he had pushed Cameron off, parallel with the edge of the step, just where one might have expected the corpse to rise, if it rose. It had risen. "Coffee, Vic?" Melinda's voice called. He peered harder, not bending his body because he did not want to arouse Melinda's curiosity, but tensing himself to concentrate all the power of his eyes. One end was lower than the other. It looked rather beige, but that could be caused by the damnable twinkling of the water, lightening Cameron's brown tweed jacket. The weight at one end might be the rock in his trousers. At any rate, the chain had come off.
"Don't you want your coffee, Vic?"
He took a last staring look, trying to estimate how conspicuous the form would be to an ordinary person standing where he was, an ordinary, unsuspecting person. Anyone seeing it would look twice, however, might even go down to investigate, especially if the Cameron story crossed his mind. Vic turned slowly.
"Coming," he said, and began to walk back.
Though Vic might have proposed leaving almost immediately in order to hear the radio concert he usually listened to on Sunday afternoons, he felt this would have been a small concession to his anxiety. So he waited until Melinda had had her coffee and a cigarette and suggested leaving herself. They packed the basket together. They were home by 3:25, and Vic at once turned on the radio in the living room. He heard the throbbing, urgent beat of the fourth movement of Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony. At least he thought it was the fourth movement. He was in no mood to care whether he was right or not. He found the music somewhat disturbing, but he kept it on. Before the concert was over, Melinda came out of her room, went out to his car, and came in again.
"Vic, I left my scarf. I put it under a rock, and I guess I forgot it."
"Would you like me to go back for it?" he asked.
"Oh, not now. You're listening to the concert. Maybe you can get it tomorrow on your way to or from work, if you don't mind. Or I will. I kind of like that scarf. I folded it and put it under a rock pretty close to the fire, on the left, facing the fire."
"All right, honey. I'll bring it home at lunch."
Vic remembered it with the stone weighing it down. It showed how upset he was, he thought, that he had not noticed it when they were packing up everything else. After dinner that evening, when Vic was reading in the living room, Melinda came in from her room and asked Vic if he wanted a nightcap. Vic said he didn't think he did. Melinda went into the kitchen to fix herself one.
On her way back through the living room, she said, "You don't have to get that scarf at noon tomorrow if you don't want to, because I have a lunch date, and I won't be in at noon anyway."
"All right," he said. He wasn't going to ask any questions. She had made at least 2 telephone calls from her room that evening, he thought.
Chapter 27. The next day, Vic left the printing plant about a quarter of an hour earlier than usual to go home for lunch, though his times for leaving at noon and in the evening were so irregular that no one would have remarked a 15-minute difference one way or the other. He drove to the quarry between Wesley and East Lyme. This time he had taken a length of strong rope, clothesline, with him from the garage, and he intended to use one end of it to secure a good-sized rock and the other end to circle Cameron's body under the arms. It was a bright, sunshiny day, and Vic did not tarry to have another look at the corpse in the water before he descended the path. He was careful going down, not wanting to tear his trousers on the brush or to scuff his shoes. Once on the flat, he approached the place slowly, avoiding looking at the corpse until he was almost at the edge of the step. It was a roll of paper. Water-soaked, pulp paper, frayed at the end and tied in 2 places that he could see with twine. The surprise, the absurdity of it, made him almost angry for a moment. Then he sighed, and the ache that went through his body made him realize how tense he had been. He looked up at the blue sky and over at the rugged crest of the opposite side of the quarry. Nothing looked down at him but a few trees. He looked back at the roll of paper. One end was lower than the other, and it was about 4/5 submerged. Vic wondered idly what kept it afloat, wondered if it had a wooden spool of some sort in its center. If he had been able to reach it with his foot, he would have shoved it out of the corner, but it was just beyond his reach. It had probably been in the quarry for months, drifting here and there with the wind. He moved closer to the edge and stared straight down at the spot where Cameron had gone off. He could faintly see the horrible-looking step, yards below in the water, and it looked quite pale, as if nothing rested on it. He turned around and looked for the bloodstains. There weren't any. It was as if another trick had been played on him. Then he saw the slight reddish discoloration between some little stones. What had happened, he realized, was that the rain or the wind had spread quite a lot of limestone dust and little fragments of stone over the stains. Pushing the stones aside with his shoe, he could see the stain now, a streak about 4 inches long and 1 inch wide, this one. But it was so pale by this time, not worth bothering about. He looked around his feet critically. Not a single stain showed except the one he had deliberately exposed. He really might have saved himself a trip down here, he thought. Carefully, using his hand, he brushed the stones and the dust back over the stain that he had uncovered.
"Hi there!"
called a voice, and the other side of the quarry echoed it. Vic looked straight up and saw a man's head and shoulders above the edge of the cliff, and recognized him almost instantly as Don Wilson.
"Hi,"
Vic called back. He had stood up. Now he began to walk casually back toward the path that led up, stiff with terror and shame, suddenly, because he remembered hearing, less than 2 minutes ago, a small, very distant-sounding impact, which he had decided to ignore and which he now realized must have been Wilson's car door closing. He might have been prepared
if he had paid attention to it. But he had thought it came from farther away than the flat above where his own car was. Wilson was moving toward Vic along the top, obviously looking for a path. He found it and plunged down. Vic, already on the path at a place too narrow to pass anyone, went back down the distance he had climbed. Wilson was down quickly, skidding and clutching.
"What are you doing?"
Wilson asked. "Oh, taking a walk. Melinda left her scarf somewhere."
"I know. I've got it,"
Wilson said, holding it up.
"What's the rope for?"
"I just happened to find it," Vic said.
"Looks practically new."
Wilson nodded, looked around him, and Vic saw his eyes fix suddenly on the roll of paper in the water.
"How've you been, Don? How's June?"
Wilson went down on the flat, apparently for a better look. He stopped short as if he, too, were surprised to find it merely a roll of brown paper. Then Vic saw Wilson look down at his feet, trying to see what he had been interested in on the rock. Vic started up the path again. Wilson was Melinda's luncheon companion, Vic supposed, and she had probably asked him to pick up the scarf on the way to Little Wesley. As simple as that. Simple and ghastly.
"Hey!"
Wilson called. Vic stopped and looked back. They had a clear view of each other. Wilson was stooped at the place where Vic had uncovered the stain.
"Is this what you were looking at? These look like bloodstains. I'm pretty sure they're bloodstains."
Vic hesitated deliberately. "I thought so, too. But I think they're rust," he said, and started to climb again. Wilson was trying to trace the stains to the water, Vic saw.
"Hey, wait a minute!"
Wilson called and walked toward him, his hands in his trench coat pockets, his upturned face scowling. He stubbed his toe on a rock and came on.
"What do you know about those stains? Why were you trying to cover them up?"
"I wasn't trying to cover them up," Vic said, and went on climbing.
"Listen, Vic, is this where you killed Cameron? I'm going to have the police take a look at this, you know. I'm going to ask them to take a look in the water. How does that make you feel?"
It made him feel naked and vulnerable. He hated presenting his backside to Wilson as he climbed the path. When he got to the top, he saw that Wilson's car was deep among the trees, standing in the lane. Wilson must have recognized his car and deliberately stopped out of earshot to spy on him.
"If your car's blocking the lane,"
Vic said to Wilson as he came up the path, "would you please back it up? Or come on through?" Wilson looked confused and angry for a moment, then lurched off in the direction of the lane. It was a minute or so before Vic heard his car start, and he waited a few moments longer to find out what Wilson was going to do, and heard the motor approaching. Vic got into his own car and started it. He was thinking that if he got rid of the other snow chain in the back of his car, the one on Cameron wouldn't be very definitely identifiable. But there was, of course, Melinda, who would be glad to identify it, and who would probably say she could identify it when she really couldn't. Vic moved his car as soon as he could, and gave Don a wave as he went by him. His one chance, Vic thought, was that Wilson might not be able to persuade the police to dredge the quarry. But if the police were convinced that the stains were blood, and unfortunately they would be convinced, they wouldn't need any prodding to look in the water. Vic glanced in the mirror for Don's car. He turned off the dirt road into the highway to Little Wesley without seeing it. Don was probably having a hard time getting through the lane. Wilson would go to the police now, Vic supposed, just as soon as he got to Little Wesley. Vic pictured the police arriving at the house while he was calmly preparing his lunch, perhaps even eating it.
He'd try bluffing Wilson again. The police already knew that Wilson was a troublemaker. The police were, after all, on his side. He might be able to discourage the police from going to look at the bloodstains, Vic thought. All it would take would be coolness. But he knew it wouldn't go like that. The police would take a look at the bloodstains. If they wouldn't, Wilson would inform Cameron's company or inform Havermal. Vic did not quite know what to do. He thought of Trixie. The Petersons would take her, he thought, if anything happened to him. He stopped thinking about that. That was defeatism. Melinda would get her anyway. That was worse to think about. But still he did not know quite what to do. He would go on about his business. That was the only way he could see it. He had expected Melinda to be gone when he got to the house. Her car was in the garage. Vic got out of his car quietly, without shutting the door, and went into the living room. Melinda was on the telephone in her room, and he heard her trying to end the conversation quickly because she knew he had come in. She came into the room, and he knew from her face that she had been talking to Don. Her face was a confusion of surprise, triumph, and terror. Then, as he kept walking toward her, she took a step back. He smiled at her. She was dressed to go out, probably to meet Don at the Lord Chesterfield. "I've just talked to Don," she said unnecessarily.
"Oh, you've just talked to Don. What would you do without the telephone?"
He walked past her into her room, wrapped the wire of her telephone around his wrist, and yanked it from the wall box.
"Well, now you haven't got one."
Then he crossed the living room to the telephone in the hall and yanked its wire out in the same manner, so hard that the box came off the wall. Melinda was standing by the phonograph, really cringing against it, in an attitude of exaggerated terror, it seemed to Vic, her mouth open and drawn down at the corners like a mask of tragedy. Medea, mangler of children and castrator of husbands. Fate had overtaken her at last. He almost smiled. What was he doing, after all? Walking toward her.
"Vic!"
"What, darling?"
"Don's coming," she gasped. "Don't do anything to me, Vic."
He struck her on the side of the head.
"So Don's coming, and who else, and who else? Cameron and Charlie and all the rest?"
He struck her again. She reached for the cloisonné vase on the top of the phonograph and knocked it off. Then he struck her again, and she was on her hands and knees on the floor.
"Vic! Help!"
Always that cry to other people. His hands closed around her throat and he shook her. The stupid terror in her open eyes made his hands tighten all the more. Then suddenly, he released her.
"Get up,"
he said. After all, he did not want to kill her. She was coughing.
"Melinda."
Then he heard a car outside, and the last barrier of his anger broke, and he threw himself on her. He imagined he saw Wilson's lank figure and scowling face coming in the door, and he put all the pressure he could on her throat, furious because she had made him furious. He could have won, he thought, without her. He could have won without the telephone that had brought Jojo and Larry and Ralph and Delisle and Cameron to the house. Ralph, the mama's boy. Cameron, the pachyderm. There was a shout at the front door, and then Wilson, self-righteous, unsmiling, meddling, was bending over Melinda, talking to her. Her lips had parted. There was a bluish look about her eyelids, or was it mascara? Or an illusion? Vic heard Wilson mutter to the empty air that she was dead, and then following the direction in which Wilson had looked, Vic saw a policeman standing.
"What are you smiling at?"
the policeman demanded, unsmiling. Vic was about to tell him, at faith, hope, and charity, when the policeman took him by the arm. Vic stood up, enduring the loathsome touch, which after a moment became comical, like Melinda's panic, with his usual amenableness. Wilson was babbling behind him, and Vic heard the words quarry and Delisle and Cameron's blood. And he kept on walking with the men who were not fit to black his boots. He saw Trixie romping up the lawn and stopping in surprise as she saw him with the policeman. But frowning at the lawn, Vic could see that she wasn't really there. The sun was shining and Trixie was alive. Somewhere. But Melinda is dead. And so am I, he thought. Then he knew why he felt empty. Because he had left his life in the house behind him, his guilt and his shame, his achievements and failures, the failure of his experiment, and his final, brutal gesture of petulant revenge. He began to walk with a spring in his step. The walk to the policeman's car at the bottom of the driveway seemed endless, and he began to feel free and buoyant and guiltless, too. He looked at Wilson, walking beside him, still intoning his tedious information and feeling very calm and happy. Vic kept looking at Wilson's wagging jaw and thinking of the multitude of people like him on the earth. Perhaps half the people on earth were of his type, or potentially his type, and thinking that it was not bad at all to be leaving them. The ugly birds without wings. The mediocre who perpetuated mediocrity, who really fought and died for it. He smiled at Wilson's grim, resentful, the world owes me a living face, which was the reflection of the small, dull mind behind it, and Vic cursed it and all it stood for. Silently, and with a smile, and with all that was left of him, he cursed it. This is Paul Baymer. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Deep Water by Patricia Highsmith. This program was directed by Christina Rooney. Executive producer, Kelly Gilday. Text copyright 1957 by Patricia Highsmith. Copyright renewed 1985 by Patricia Highsmith. Production copyright 2014, Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.